For 40 years, John Haddon and his father of the same name fought at the dinner table over politics, art, and various issues concerning America. One was haunted by what he had witnessed during his long CIA career from Berlin to Tel Aviv. The other retreated to the Vermont woods to direct Shakespeare until finally he confronted his father at the table one last time with a tape recorder. His book, Conversations with a Masked Man, is a series of conversations Haddon had with his father about the older man's 30-year career as a CIA officer and how American policy affected the family and the world. John Haddon has worked in the theater for 40 years. He was artistic director of Hubbard Hall Theater Company, a founding member of Shakespeare and Company, associate artist with We Players, and co-founder and artistic director of Counterpoint Theater in Boston. His solo show, Travels with a Masked Man, is composed of excerpts from the book. Again, the title of the book is Conversations with a Masked Man, My Father, the CIA, and Me. And it's a great pleasure to welcome John Haddon back to the roundtable. John, always good to see you.
Thanks, Joe.
How are you?
Great, great.
So, I knew you were doing the show for a bit, but reading the story is just incredible. And I have to say...
I'm looking forward to what you're laughing at.
This is the honest reaction I had when I started to read the book is all those conversations I've had with John, I now feel wasted because I have a lot more questions for him. This is an amazing life that you've led that I really had no idea about.
It's funny. This has to do with, you know, divulging about oneself and one's life. And it's always been difficult for me. And I think it's partly because for my father, success meant that nobody knew anything about what he was doing.
Right.
If anybody had any idea what he was doing, it was a botch. And that somehow came into me, you know, whether it was through my DNA or whatever. So it's a very strange thing to be a theater person in which, you know, success depends on absolute anonymity and nobody really knowing what you're doing and what you're there for.
And
so
this...
it's been a kind of paradox of my life.
And this story doesn't come until your father passes, really.
Well, no. The story is a continuation.
Wanting to tell everybody else?
No. It started before.
Okay.
I started interviewing him not long after 9/11. I asked him in a letter whether he'd be interested in my interviewing him for a possible book. And he said yes, just like that. And it just bowled me over. It was by far the most straightforward transaction we'd ever conducted. And then I thought, oh, my God, now what? Oh, my God, what have I let myself in for? Yeah. And, you know, as a point of honor and everything else, yeah, here we go. Of course, after a couple of years of interviewing him and writing about it, he took a look at what I'd put together. And bit by bit, he realized, no, actually, I can't let this go. I can't let this go out. He still had contacts with lots of people in the government and in Israel, and he wanted to keep those things clear. And not that he was hiding what he thought, but he wanted to be the instrument of what he said himself. And so that's when the show came out, because I this material was just popping out of me, and I had to do something with it. So I made a show out of it, excluding the sensitive political stuff. And the first time I did it was really for an audience in which he was present, so that I could see whether I had the ethical right to go on and doing it. And he enjoyed it, and we actually had a lot of fun talking about it. I could hear him chuckling during the show. And so then I went ahead and did it for several years, bit by bit, evolving it. And so that actually came before this final revision of the book and before I found a publisher and so on. And then he died. And before he died, he said, yeah, absolutely. Go for it. Publish it. And here, this is where my files are. And here's who you can talk to. And go ahead.
Okay. So
really interested in getting it out.
Yeah. So that gave you the go ahead.
Yeah.
When upon his passing to say,
that's right.
Here's everything. Go for broke on this.
That's right.
And there had to have been some great freedom in that of saying, oh, it was a really great story I couldn't tell, and now I can.
Yes. Yes. And I also found out that the conversation was extended beyond his death. So that all the references that he littered his conversation with, I had to go look them all up. And, you know, like Clausewitz, the Enlightenment philosopher of war, I had no idea. You know, I would just kind of nod when he would throw these things at me. Well, now I had to go back and find out who they all were. And it was fascinating. And it deepened, add all kinds of layers to the conversation. And sometimes I wonder if I've just been delaying my mourning of his loss by keeping the conversation going in a funny way. Do you know what I mean?
I do, but isn't that part of the mourning?
Maybe, yeah.
You know, I think having those conversations is vital in that process. It seems to me, and correct me if I'm wrong, my takeaway in reading the book was that because one of the questions that I would ask someone doing what you're doing would be, when you were putting the book together, were there any regrets of saying, oh, God, I wish I had asked that question, or I wish I had done this, or I don't get that sense with you. You don't seem like you have regrets.
I don't. I mean, the process for me, I was aiming at something that had to do with getting all kinds of answers. And so that's what I was aiming at, the thing you're talking about, about being really satisfied by, you know, understanding who this man was and what were his motivations and what was he really up to and all that. And why, you know, and why did I end up in this family? Because my mother was there before he was in the CIA. And I never knew about it until I was 17. And then I thought, boy, what a moron, looking back on it. How could I not have figured that out? But what I got out of it is much more interesting to me now, which is that I appreciate him in a much deeper way. And I'm not dependent on those kinds of answers. I'm full of questions, but I don't feel like I should have asked this or that, or I wish I'd gone deeper. It felt like a real complete meal.
When you have a mother and a father in the CIA, I assume there is some sort of protocol as to how the children find out what mom and dad do for a living.
Yes. Yeah. When I found out, which I did by accident from a friend of his who didn't realize, a new wife of a friend who didn't realize what the protocol was. Before that, after that, he said, you know, you were safer if you didn't know. So if you'd ever been taken and interrogated, they would know right away that you just didn't know, and they'd go easy on you. And so it was for your safety that this was kept from you. And I think that's pretty much the way those children are treated.
Do we? Well, let me ask you as a question, I guess. How do you think we as a nation view those as those who have served their country in the CIA? It's much different than serving their country in the military. We think of it differently, don't we?
Well, especially since the CIA mushroomed into doing a lot of dirty operations. My father was really interested in pure intelligence from human sources. And ironically, what that relies on is trust. And what he felt was that that trust was being constantly eroded as he was going through his career in what they call the company. And so he was appalled afterwards.
Was there a pride that he had in serving his country for 30 years,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. Well, that included his time at West Point.
Yes.
And as an Army engineer. So it was about 25 or so.
But both service to the country.
All service to the country. Yeah, he was a devoutly patriotic person. His uncle had left the seminary in order to go to the trenches as a foot soldier because he wanted to give comfort to the GIs there. And so at a great deal of sacrifice. And so he saw that as as the sort of the paragon of honor to serve your country. And to, and he also wanted, he had a kind of blue collar mentality. He just wanted to do good work. He wanted to be of service. And it was tough for him when he just saw the whole thing eroding, and he saw the our foreign policy eroding, you know, everything just crumpling. And he kept saying that Gibbon would have given his eye teeth to be here at a ringside seat at the crumbling of the empire. You know, what a pleasure to watch this unfold,
yeah,
or deteriorate. But there was a kind of bleak irony in his humor all the way through.
When you would have conversations that fathers and sons have about the world that we live in and the craziness, I mean, did you think of it in that, because some you had the context of knowing what he did and others you didn't, of looking back on it now, of what he was, the context that he had for those conversations that of course you and most of us don't have?
You mean the conversations that he had in his work?
Yeah. Well, I mean, the conversations that you would have, the father and son conversations that we all have. And if you have those conversations, I was saying in the introduction, you know, this conversation you have at the dinner table, you're talking about politics, you're talking about this, you're talking about that.
Yeah, and didn't you find that those conversations, that the politics was a kind of vessel for you to have it out with your father? I mean,
is
that what happened to you?
Yes, to find out, sure. Although, you know, I usually found myself agreeing, with a little bit of a generational, I was the youngest of five kids. So there was, you know, 40 or whatever there was difference, between us, but it is, it's still fascinating, but do you feel that looking back on those conversations that your father had such a different context?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I see what you, and also he couldn't say what he really thought.
Right.
And so there was that whole kind of plumbing problem in the conversation. I mean, I found out way, way later, for instance, that he was appalled by the Vietnam War. But at the time that we were going head-to-head about it, he was defending it to me. And I think it's because he didn't trust me to say what, you know, he didn't want anybody to know what he really thought. He saw himself as purely a soldier of the administration.
So a masked man.
Yeah.
So when you remove that mask.
Well, that was the idea, was to try and it turned out that he was the immovable object and his mask was not going to be removed. If anything, it was about me finding out about myself.
Yeah.
And, you know, and finding out about the kinds of things that I had rejected about myself that actually came right from him, that I could have made use of, you know, a certain kind of grit, a certain kind of like tuck your head down and just push ahead, you know, all kinds of great qualities that he had that I'm just now discovering.
John Haddon is our guest. The name of the new book is Conversations with a Masked Man, My Father, the CIA, and Me. Does writing a book, having those continual conversations now, does being on stage, does that help you explore this?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, especially, I mean, I'm a theater animal, so that's my favorite place for this, is to jump back and forth between, yeah, I play both guys going at it. So my father's constantly interrupting me. So it's a trick for me to find out, you know, where can I take a breath? But the heart, so what happens is, I love what happens in a room when you can begin to feel the silence in between the words and the people are, and you can feel the wavelengths start to align. And so I get, most of what I get by doing this comes from what I get from people that I see out there in the audience and their sense of, oh yeah, I remember something like that. Or, you know, when I see my father next, this is what I'm going to ask. You can sort of tell that there's something going on that has to do with their lives. And that's what I'm really interested in.
Is this a set piece now, or is it still movable? Where there are parts?
No, it's very shaped. So it's as precise as I possibly can get it. So I'm constantly whittling away at these incremental moments. And then when I get that down, then I can feel free. And that's the way I've always felt about theater.
So how do you feel that it is different now than it was when your father first saw it?
I trust it more. Mm-hmm. And so I've gotten rid of almost all the explanation, you know, the narrative that, you know, you step outside it and you explain something.
Right.
The exposition.
Yes.
So I used to have a bunch of that in there, and I felt uncomfortable about doing it. I just got rid of all that. And more it seems to work that they're just there. They just see the conversation. They see the problems happening right in front of them. So it's more active. There's the conflict is bigger. The stakes are higher. I trust it more, so I can explore the difficulty more, the pain, and the humor. It's outrageous. I mean, his non sequiturs are brilliant. And so that's another thing, is just treasuring the gift of these words and these stories that he's given me. Mm-hmm. And his kind of cussed refusal to go into his own psyche and to say, well, what does it mean to him? He just won't go there.
What do you think he would have made had, well, ask it as a question and then let's venture forth give you a possible scenario. And the question is, what did he make of you going into the theater? And what do you think he would have made if God forbid, when you were 17, going, oh, okay, you're in the CIA. I would like to do that too.
Well, he saw himself as a failure. At least that's what he would say to me.
How did he fail? How did he see himself failing?
Well, he saw the whole game, as he called it, as a puerile occupation. He says that again and again. And that for instance, the Soviet Union, who were so much more adept and sophisticated at this game than we were, and had a long tradition, and were way more willing to make sacrifices of lives and whatever it took to play the trick, that it didn't do them any good, that they just fell apart. They just lost in a walk, he says. So it's a game that has no actual purpose, and so when he saw me going into the theater, first of all, there's all kinds of contradictions at every turn. He took me to really amazing theater pieces all through my life. He loved the James Bond movies, for instance.
Yeah.
And he loved Yellow Submarine, of all things. You know, and then afterwards he would say, you know, this
Well, that's when you should have known his thoughts on the war.
Yeah. So, you know, yeah, exactly. And, you know, he Angleton, the crazy head of counterintelligence at the CIA, was constantly trying to ambush him into revealing that he was the fifth man, that there was this huge leak to the Soviets, and Angleton was kind of constantly trying to track it down. Well, my father loved playing these games with him, and would kind of coax him into thinking he was right, and then he would just laugh. But sometimes I wonder, where did he really stand? It's very hard to tell, really.
And of course,
I know that he hated being in Washington. He loved being overseas, in the field, and he loved talking with the Israelis, with the Austrians, with the Poles.
Us about the picnic.
The picnic.
Tell us about the picnic.
Well, now here's an example of how dunderheaded I was about not getting it. One day, we were in Israel, and we went out in his Ford Falcon, couldn't be more obvious, right out into the one road that goes into the Negev. Back in 65, this would have been, I was about 12. And then he pulls over to the side of the road, nothing on the horizon except the dome of Dimona, the nuclear reactor, and then the razor wire that surrounds it. And he got us all out of the car. We were all there, the four kids and my mom. And he handed out peanut butter sandwiches, perfectly wrapped in wax paper, which my mother did, like a pack of cards. And then he dove into the trunk and pulled out a pair of garden shears. And I think this is why I remember this, is because he had no interest in gardening whatsoever. I'd never seen him with a garden tool. I'd seen him with all kinds of other tools. But he went around clipping little shrubs and throwing them in the trunk and then shutting the trunk, herding us back into the car. We've had two or three bites of the sandwich, turns around and heads back. And that's a picnic in the desert. And it just made no sense whatsoever. And I think that's why I remember it. It turns out later, and I found out a lot about this by talking to a new friend, Roger Mattson, who has a book out now of his own, about the Numek affair, in which leakage of uranium that they couldn't account for in a couple of hundred kilograms of it disappeared. Weapons grade, high grade uranium, bomb fuel. The isotopic signature on those shrubs that my father clipped exactly matched the uranium that was coming out of the plant in Apollo, Pennsylvania. And so that's what he was doing. He was finding some conclusive hard evidence that's where it came from, the fuel for the Israeli nuclear arsenal. And I think that's a lot of what he wanted people to know about, because he thought even for the health of the state of Israel, that it would be good to be just come clean with it, and so that we can talk plausibly about a nuclear-free Middle East, for instance.
At what point do you come to the understanding, the joint understanding between the two of you, that you basically in some way have the same profession? You're both acting.
Huh. Oh, God. It's weird that question hasn't come up before. Well, for one thing, his character is way more theatrical than mine. When I do my show, I had a hard time figuring out who I was. How do you know, what's that made of? He was easy. He was outrageous, and he had developed a caricature like the old vaudevillians, and he had this voice that he did, and he would throw around all this kind of World War II lingo. Had to knock off the sauce, for instance. And he had these nonsense mottos that he would repeat, like mantras that went like, never trust anybody. Bongo, bongo, bongo. You know, these things that he would just kind of reel off when he was trying to figure out what to really go into, when he was trying to outwit his opponent. So this was part of his technique. For me, I went into it because I felt uncomfortable in almost every social situation. It was hard for me to say what I really thought. And then when I got into Shakespeare, I discovered that it was on stage, when people thought I was playing a role, that I could actually drop the role and express myself completely through the words of the Shakespeare. Mm. So it's mirrors and mirrors. But I think there's a lot more, as you suspect, I think there's a lot more parallel stuff going on between us than I ever realized. But I'm sort of just starting to get it.
The book is fascinating. It is Conversations with a Masked Man, My Father, the CIA, and Me. And I was looking for to find out when your next event is. Do you know?
I've got all my events, which include the solo show and bookstore events, on maskedman.org.
maskedman.org, and you'll find out. But you're pretty much all over the place. You're doing.
But I'm all over the place. I'm doing one at Six Depot in West Stockbridge next weekend.
And then you're at the Odyssey at the end of the month.
Yeah, I'm doing something at Eastworks, a show at Eastworks in East Hampton. And so they're coming in every day. I'm booking.
Well, John Haddon, thank you very much.
Thanks,
great
Joe.
Pleasure.
Thanks. It's great talking with
thank you.
You.